It's amazing. I can make a record real aggressive. I can make it real romantic. I can make it real comfortable. I can make it uncomfortable just with equalization. Dip here, boost here, whatever we want to create. Sometimes we can change it pretty radically, even though we're not the mixers.
It's Ohm's Law, a podcast about the visionaries, entrepreneurs, and the artists that shape our music and how we listen to it. I'm Paul McGowan. Join me as we get to know some of the most interesting people in the world of music. On today's program, Bernie Grundman, one of the most prominent names in the world of mastering of record albums and CDs. Bernie's been responsible for mastering hundreds of gold and platinum records like Carole King's Tapestry, Steely Dan's Asia, and Michael Jackson's Thriller. He was also responsible for piecing together and then mastering Miles Davis's seminal work, Kind of Blue. For Bernie, it all started when he was a kid growing up in Minnesota.
Yeah, I'm one of those fortunate people that kind of pretty much knew the kind of directions that I would be going in at about 6 years old or 7 years old. And I was raised, you know, at that time, when I was that young, I was in Minnesota, Minneapolis. And my dad was in the Junior Chamber of Commerce for Minneapolis. And he used to bring home a 16-millimeter projector. You know, there used to be a lot of those floating around. They'd use them in schools various places.
Yeah.
And of course, I was fascinated by that in itself. But I was always fascinated. I mean, a lot of people are fascinated in because of the content, you know, of what's on the screen. I was fascinated by how is this happening? How can they do this?
Sure.
Or the machinery, you know, it's always the machinery and the equipment and so forth. And also he had my dad would play old 78 records. And that also fascinated me. You know, the music's fine, but I was like, wow, you know, look at this thing. And it's colorful, you know, the labels on the records and stuff. But one of the bigger, that's why I always say my first love was motion pictures because of the equipment was so impressive. Like I used to be, my mother was a bookkeeper at the neighborhood theater in Minneapolis, in our neighborhood, because that's the way it used to be. There were a lot of theaters.
Sure.
And she was a bookkeeper there. And every Saturday I'd go down, sometimes I'd get a haircut in the same building. You know, it was one of those buildings where there were stores down below. And then the theater was there too. And I would go to the, I don't know what it was, 15, 20 cent matinee for kids and stuff.
Yeah.
But I would be sitting there thinking about and looking to the back of the theater and to the front of the, you know, like looking at this huge thing and the big screen and all this stuff going on and wondering, you know, being fascinated by the process. And so my mother worked up on the second floor where the offices were, and I would go to see her after I would see the movie, and I would draw pictures of the theater and so forth. And you know, just little diagrams or just pretend that I was running a theater or something. And she'd say, well, yeah, you're really interested in this. Well, yeah, I'll show you where the projectors are and so forth. And I didn't know. I was like 6 or 7 years old. So she took me down the hall and they opened the door. And here are these two big arc projectors. You know how big those things are.
Yeah.
And wow. I was just like, oh, I was just shocked. I had an old Cushman motor scooter. You probably don't know what that is.
Oh, I remember very well, but tell us.
They had kind of a turtle back, you know, kind of rounded back. I had one of those. I bought it used for like $25. And I used to ride that thing back and forth from the film library in the middle of Phoenix out to the neighborhood that I lived in. And I mean, in those days, even if you were 14, the police didn't care in Phoenix. There was only 50,000 people in the whole city. It was like just a resort town. So And my mother worked at one of the big resorts there as their office manager and all that kind of stuff. But what happened is I would be driving down one of the main streets to go home, and there was a little strip mall that they built, you know, the kind that faces the street, but it's just got a little bit of parking area in front of it.
Right.
And then the sidewalk and then the street. Well, there was this place that opened up called High Fidelity Sound Systems. And I'm riding by this every day. During the summer, I'd work at the film library every day. I'd be riding by this thing, and I could see in the window these big speakers, you know, because everybody was hobbyists then. A lot of people were building their own cabinets.
Sure.
They were putting together their own speaker systems from kits, or they would even build amplifiers from kits and so forth. So this guy had, you know, like speakers just sitting on the shelves. And they had, like, if you remember, university speakers.
Yeah, of course.
They were very heavy, beefy, really impressive looking, just like the Altex, you know. They were really power speakers. And but I saw this, you know, I would see that, and I thought, oh, I got to stop in here. Because that attracts me, all that stuff, you know, all of the equipment and stuff. And,
sure.
And he had a Mac 30 there, which is very impressive. You know, it's with the chrome and the black and
yeah,
all.
Glowing tubes. And
oh, the whole thing, you know. So I walked in there, and this guy that owned it, I think his family had money from Chinese restaurants. It was a Chinese guy. And so I came in there, and I met him, you know, and I'm walking around. I'm just this kid. I'm walking around, and they had some big speakers. They had unfinished cabinets. They had stuff that was fitting. You know, you could get it any way you wanted in those days. And so I'm looking at the Mac amplifier, and I'm looking around kind of drooling. He must have seen me kind of like just with my eyes big as saucers. And he says, hey, let me play you something. And I said, okay, great. And he put on this record. I don't remember the speaker system. And I'm telling you, it was probably the most profound thing that I had ever experienced up to that time. I was just shocked at how good it sounded compared to what I'd been listening to. I was just, from that day on, it was all over for me. I ended up, when I was still at my mother's house, with a 12x12 bedroom with two Bozak concert grands in there, which is a total of 28 speakers.
Oh my God.
The 14 in each big box.
Yeah.
You know, and two turntables, a pair of Marantz 50-watt amplifiers and Marantz preamps, and a little bed.
Now, how old were you?
Well, I was probably, at that time, maybe 17 or 18 or something like that, maybe 18. I was just totally taken with the whole thing. And I was also very interested in music. So I mean, it's a pretty mm-hmm. good combination for the kind of work I do, because, you know, it's good to have a technical background, but you really have to understand music too, and you have to be able to get connected with it emotionally in order to be a mastering engineer. Even to be a mixer, you have to know that when you're doing things, when you're adjusting things, you have to know if you're getting a better emotional connection with the music. Because that's all music is anyway, is an emotional expression of the human experience.
So how does an engineer or a mastering engineer, how do you impact an emotional experience like that?
Well, I mean, it's amazing. I can make a record real aggressive. I can make it real romantic. I can make it real comfortable. I can make it uncomfortable just with equalization.
Really?
Oh, of course. Here, when we're mastering, we have a lot of control over the spectrum. We've got like 36 ranges that we can play around with and push and pull and dip here, boost here, whatever we want to create. So we can change a thing. Sometimes we can change it pretty radically, even though we're not the mixers.
So you're not actually changing the volume level between the tracks and the musicians.
No. Yeah, we're not. We don't have control of each track. Yeah, we don't have of each instrument in that way. But we can approximate. We can get into the range where that instrument is, and we can manipulate mm-hmm. it, and we can change it up to a point. Now, we don't have the flexibility that a mixer has, but those things aren't always very perfect, you know, when they mix things over a period of time, the consistency isn't there. The flow of the album, we put that all together, the way it flows, the way the spacing from the tunes, that's part of mastering, is part of making this thing sound like a cohesive experience. So we're trying to have some similarity from tune to tune. We don't want anything that's too uncomfortable between tunes. We want it to flow. But we also wanted to communicate, if possible, better than the way it came into us. And the only way we're going to know that, and this is a joint, this is the collaborative, you know, we have to do tests. If the client isn't there, we have to send them a test, and we have to find out if we're really in the right direction. Because we can do some modification that show them what we think might actually make this thing speak a little better and connect better. And so it's one of those things. It's a little bit trial and error. You try different things, but you still have to be emotionally available to the music, or else you wouldn't know what to do.
I know you worked on the 3-track master of Kinda Blue, Miles Davis. Obviously, he was not present for the mastering of that. It's a gorgeous recording. You honored the music, so...
Well, yeah. Well, I'm actually a jazz bebopper. That's my whole love in music, is classical music and jazz bebop. So that's right down my alley, that kind of music. And also, we did this in a different way than it's ever been done. That was done right from the original 3 tracks. And see, because when Columbia made that recording, they did it on the 3-track, of course, but they mixed it down and they added reverb when they mixed it down. They did a lot of the processing and various changes and things to create a stereo, because that's what the medium is. We don't have a 3-track medium, really. So they had to mix it down, but they had to make a submaster so that they could cut discs and do whatever, you know, to release it on vinyl. And in those days, in those major labels, you know, the mastering engineer did not adjust the sound. In fact, the reason why they were called mastering engineers in those days was all they were supposed to do was cut a master. And they were supposed to know how to make a good disc that would track properly and had no, you know, idiosyncrasies that would make it difficult to plate, maybe.
So when you say master, Bernie, you mean the actual master stamping thing?
Lacquer. I'm just talking about the master lacquer. If you were in Columbia, if you were a producer at Columbia, and you mixed six, and everything was 15 IPS in those days. You know, it was a quarter inch 15. Okay, so if you mixed down all your album and you take it into the mastering engineer, he just set a level and cut it flat. Okay, you would take that disc home, and if the second tune needed some top end or bottom end or whatever, you know, some little adjustment, you had to go back in the studio, do a 2-to-2 or a 1-to-1 transfer, depending on mono or stereo, and do the EQ in the studio, and then insert a copy with that EQ into the assembly, and then the mastering engineer would cut it flat. It was not a creative part of the business in the mid-60s, up to the mid-60s. And that's when I got in the business. And because I got in at Contemporary Records, and the interesting thing about that studio, it was always in-house stuff. They only did their direct-to-2-track recordings of, you know, Art Pepper Meets the Rhythm Section, Sonny Rollins' Way Out West, those famous albums. Those were all done. It's all kind of, they had their own little cutting room. They had their own little studio. What they had done is they had customized this whole system to accommodate these direct-to-2-track recordings that many times were not really ideally mixed. They weren't happy with the way they came out, but because it was jazz And if you had a take that had the best solos and so forth, they wanted to have the ability to improve the mix in mastering, because not like pop music where you can kind of keep doing it over and over again, you'd probably be okay and you get it the way you want it. But in jazz, you don't want to give up that great performance, because you can't just do it again and it's going to be wonderful. So they built a system that had all of this stuff in the chain. You could adjust the high end, you could adjust the lows, you could adjust, and you could even pan different frequency bands across from one side to the other, or into the center, or whatever you want. You had all this manipulation that you could do. For its day, it was a lot of manipulation. It's nothing like what we do nowadays, but...
Sure. Now, what year was this?
I started there in 66, 1966.
Okay. Everything is analog at this point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There was no talk at all of digital. Digital didn't come in early 80s. Because Lester wasn't making really any new recordings, and we were just mastering the catalog whenever we needed extra parts or new parts to go to the factory, he opened the studio to custom work. Word got around town. If they brought their product to me, I could adjust it on the fly. So all of a sudden, I started getting a following. So I got in the business at the right time when it became a creative part, and I had the system in front of me. I had the tools to adjust it. And so, I mean, within a year, though, Doug Sachs opened his place. But I was there about a year before Doug doing this kind of thing of doing... They create a certain amount of creative stuff at the very end of this whole process of making a record. So I was able to start attracting a lot of other label people like The Doors and Dionne Warwick and Brazil 66, Herb Alpert stuff and all that. Because I was doing so much A&M work, that's why I ended up at A&M 2 years later. In our studio, and we have always done this, we build all of our own preamps for the tape playback. We build, the whole console is built by hand with all discrete components. It's a very high quality system, and it's a system where we even have it all modular so that only the frequency we're equalizing is in the circuit. We can actually punch everything out and be direct right from the tape right to the lathe. So part of it's that, because a lot of systems, it's going through a lot of line amps and various things, and everything degrades it, you know. So because we're old audiophiles, all of us around here, we built the system so that we can have nothing if we want to. If the recording's that good, and some of the stuff I've done in the past for Classic or any of these Ying Groove Note or any of those places, or these Lynn Stanley things, we can go right off the tape and go right into. We even have an outboard level control, so it only goes through very minimal electronics just to control level, or we can patch in. Or introduce a more simplified equalization if we want. We have all kinds of different ways of going just to keep it minimum. Yeah, as pure as we can. But if we need something, though, to create the right kind of balances in the spectrum and so forth, that's more important than quality. But we want it so that it's so good that you're not going to hear much difference.
What about compression?
Well, I don't like to use it in these kind of recordings. You know, I do.
And most of us don't like to hear it.
No. And we almost never do. It's the only time I actually, if something's really out of control, you have to. I mean, you just can't cut something that's really not controlled.
Yeah.
I mean, like The only one I remember where I really had to do more than I normally do was Norah Jones's first album, the big hit for her.
Come away with me in the night.
I did the vinyl on that. And they mixed it to tape. It was tape. But the vocal peaks, if you're a mixer, you know, and you're recording, you know, a lot of vocalists, you don't even hear it as loud, but the meters are slamming all over the place with vocal peaks.
Right.
And that's what was on that tape. They didn't control it in the mix. And Ted Jensen at Sterling did the mastering for CD. And so I called him up and I said, hey, you know, how did you deal with this? You know, he said, actually, I put it in the computer and I lowered everyone in the computer, not with a compressor, but in the computer by drawing down the waveforms.
Right.
And that's a lot of work. But also, I couldn't do anything like that because I can't stop and just do one thing at a time like that on a tape. You can't do it on the tape. You can't. There's no way. And I wanted the quality of the tape. So we have a very good compressor that we build ourselves. And it's got all these very fancy VCAs. We took a SSL compressor and we completely gutted it, but we kept the same parameters, the same attack release and ratios and so forth. We kept those, but it has all of our line amps, our power supply, and these special VCAs. And I could switch that in and out. You almost can't hear anything. You can't,
wow.
It's so clean.
But if the Norah Jones tape had such large peaks, the dynamic range of tape and vinyl are pretty similar, why wouldn't the tape have over-modulated and distorted?
It depends on what their reference was, how the tape was set up. Problem is with a disc is you have a noise floor that you have to be careful of, because if we left those vocal peaks go as far as just a normal amount, the rest of it would be very low. It would be down in the noise too much. And besides, it didn't sound right. I mean, because it was too jumpy. You know, it just wasn't like, I thought the CD sounded great. That's why I put the CD up, and I wanted to hear, you know, the balances and how it was integrated and everything, because I was seeing all of this slamming and crazy peaks that really needed to be controlled, because that kind of energy, when it gets in the groove, is difficult for a lot of cartridges. So I wanted to be more similar to the CD anyway. So I just put in our compressor, and after playing around with a lot of parameters in the compressor, I could actually have it duplicate exactly what he did. And you wouldn't even hear it. You don't even hear it working. And so I was able to get the sound I wanted.
When we hear differences between the album and the CD, which we all do, part of that is because they were actually done differently. They were mastered differently. Is that normal?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. So, of course, it's going to sound different, because no two equalizers, unless they have the same ones I do, they're not going to sound the same. I mean, you could have on your notes plus two at 10K. Well, my two at 10K is different than your two at 10K. Depends on the ratio. I mean, the Q.
Well, how much is the difference? You know, audiophiles talk a lot about how much better vinyl is versus CD and the other way around. How much of that is due to the fact that vinyl and CDs are mastered differently, in your opinion?
Well, you know, I think what they don't like about CDs is no matter what you do, and we've done, you know, we had a few little records that we put out and CDs that we put up when we were trying to do little audiophile things here. And we would run 30 IPS quarter-inch tapes on a souped-up ATR machine on these sessions. And we had two computers that we ran simultaneously, one at 9624 and the other one at 4416 for CDs. The 9624, it didn't matter. When you listen to the quarter inch, it's just better. It's just more natural. It sounded exactly like what was coming off the microphones. There's something that happens in digital that's different. It's not quite as natural. It's more of a, I don't know what you'd call it, a slight artificial thing that creeps in there because of all the processing it takes to convert it to digital and to convert it back to analog.
Do you hear the same in DSD?
Oh, yeah. Same thing. There's an electronic sound to it. I'm not saying it's not impressive, but when you think about it, the way digital works, because the signal is broken up into a lot of pieces, there's something, it's primarily in the top end, and it's always a little thinner to me. It's not, and it's hard, when you think about top end being fat, that doesn't make sense in some ways, but in a way it does, because there's a certain size that I feel in the top end that's better on analog. Whereas in digital, it has a precision. It sounds very clinical at times because it sometimes sounds much more defined than the analog. But it isn't really, it's actually that there's stuff missing.
You know Michael Fremmer.
Oh, yeah. He's around here all the time.
I'll bet he is. I recognize exactly what you're saying. And one of the curious things that Michael and I argue about on a regular basis is this. If he makes a digital recording of his vinyl, it sounds nearly identical to the vinyl. And he takes a CD and it doesn't.
Yeah, so it will.
What's the difference? If you take a vinyl record that's been mastered from a tape and you make a digital copy of it, why does that sound less digital than an actual CD?
Well, you know, a CD goes through quite a few processes. I mean, when he just records direct to a CD, that's a lot different than what you end up with buying in the store when you buy a CD. I mean, because we have to put it on the computer, and then we have to make a submaster, and many times nowadays, there's another processing that goes through at the factory, and then they do it at high speed. They do the glass master at high speed. You're like four more generations down. And contrary to what everyone would like to believe, every generation you're going to lose.
Sure. That makes so you think it's the generational loss and the processing.
Well, that's part of it. It's hard to say what all this stuff has gone through. That's the problem, I think. Now, even also some of the reason why I think people like what's coming off the vinyl is that a lot of cartridges, you know, kind of have a rising characteristic in the high end. And they give you this kind of airy thing. That actually isn't like what was intended. Do you know what I mean?
No, I do exactly. Yeah. Or on the bottom end, they can be really fat on the bottom.
You can line up 10 cartridges. They all sound different. You know, the thing, the whole problem with vinyl is that it's more of a moving target than digital. In other words, you know, there's cartridges that are $50 and there's cartridges that are $10,000. And they're all going to sound different because they're transducers. The thing that makes the biggest difference in this whole industry are transducers. When you're changing something from something to something different, like from electrical to mechanical, those are the hardest things to do. A microphone, changing acoustical, mechanical energy to electrical, a speaker, a cutter head even.
What do you use for speakers, Bernie, when you master?
Well, I have we have something that we put together. We build our own crossovers, and we have put together speakers that we like the sound of, that we find are really, really neutral. They don't color the sound. They don't give you a lot of sizzle if it's not there. They don't give you air if it's not there. If it's a bad recording, they sound terrible. But they're actually a combination of different vintages of Tannoy speakers. So what we use are their old high impedance tweeters for the high end. It's a coax. It's not like an Altec coax or some of these that have a horn on them. It's got the tweeters in the throat of the woofer so that it flares. Like the tweeter comes out of the back of the speaker, but it when it meets the woofer cone is still part of the flare of the tweeter. And so what happens is, depending on the woofer that you have there, is going to change the mid-range. We like these old 16-ohm tweeters because they're very clean and they don't buzz and do a lot of this sizzly stuff that I don't like. They're old-fashioned compression style. They're not dome tweeters. And we like the combination of that 16-ohm tweeter with the woofer cone. The woofer was terrible. but we like from 1,000 up. So we use two of these speakers, but we only use the tweeter in one and the woofer in the other, and they're side by side in a cabinet.
Is there a future for the quality mastering that you do? I mean, you're what, 73 years old?
Six.
How long are you going to keep doing this? I mean, is there a future in this? I think it's great.
I don't know.
I love what you're doing.
Yeah, well, you know, we're still old audiophiles, and we definitely know that the only way you know if you're getting anywhere is by listening to it, because there's nothing that can measure the complexity of a piece of music. You can't measure the distortion. You know, you can measure IM distortion and harmonic distortion and all that stuff, but it's simple measurements, and it gets you kind of in the ballpark, but it does not tell you what it's going to sound like in music. So you can only use your ears to really tell if you've improved something, because we do it all the time. We're tinkering with our equipment and stuff and trying different things, different even wires, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And the only way we know is by listening. I mean, the other day, and they're doing this to me all the time, my two tech guys, they'll call me in and they'll say, okay, I'm going to play you two things. You pick which one you like. So they'll play me the same thing that they've recorded through something, you know, whatever they've done. And usually it's pretty noticeable. You know, I'm used to listening to these systems. And like the other day, they had me listen to something, some digital thing they were working on. They were fooling around with the computer. And so I picked out the one that I liked, and I said, well, there's a big difference here. I mean, this is obviously the best one. I mean, it's just more airy, more detailed. It was just sounded much better. And I said, well, what's the difference? And all they had done is the connector on the computer, they had changed the pins. And the pins that didn't sound good were ones that were supposed to be better. And anybody would hear it in a listening environment where you're just A-Bing. It was not, I mean, because some of these things are so subtle, you might pick some of the time one and some of the time the other. This happens all the time. When it's like that, it probably isn't relevant. You know, because if they're that close together, it probably doesn't matter. But when you're always picking the same one, and this happened with Pro Tools guys. They came down years ago because we were always complaining about copies. And they brought down all of their equipment. They had this huge rack of equipment. So we were doing copies. And they were doing the inversion thing. And they said, these copies are absolutely perfect. Blah, 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 blah. And we picked out the copy every time.
And how'd they respond to that?
Oh, they were freaked out. They said, oh, God, they said, we don't know what you're hearing, but you're obviously hearing something.
Welcome to my world of audiophiles.
It's nice to have the theory, and everything should follow theory. But the problem is, it doesn't sound as good. It doesn't sound as good when it does that.
Well, Bernie, I certainly appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Yeah, no problem.
This has been great.
I've been doing this for so long. I've been doing it 50 years now, so.
Well, we all, as a community, hope you keep doing it another 50 years.
It's been so much a part of me because I'm a true audiophile because I hung out at that hi-fi shop all the time, you know, and it was constantly, all my money went to it. So, yeah, I get it, you know. And it's a great pursuit anyway, to always, because, you know, being in the business, as good as it can be, it's never quite as good as what we hear off the speakers. And so the goal is still there, how to make it even better and get to the public what we're hearing.
That's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed our time together. Ohm's Law is brought to you by PS Audio, a company dedicated to great sound in service of music. This is Paul McGowan, inviting you to join us for more podcasts of Ohm's Law, available on our website, psaudio.com/podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. You can tweet us at psaudio or email us, ohmslaw@psaudio.com.